Welcome to the Holistic Health Podcast, beautiful humans. If a professional, polished, well-edited podcast is what you're after, then move right on.
If, however, you love unfiltered banter, unedited bloopers, authentic heart sharing, and a very generous dash of holistic health education, then you're in the right place. Hello, friends. It's Nat Naimi here again with another very exciting episode. And I feel like this is a timely moment in the year, seeing as we're in that month where everyone's reviewing their health and setting new intentions to just really look at some of those basics around longevity and preventing major diseases. And so in this episode, we're going to cover, this is going to be a part one. We want to talk about ways in which you can statistically reduce your risk of cancer. And this is very much going to be, here's a proactive list of what to do, not a scare the shit out of you and, oh my gosh, you're going to die WebMD style. But what I want to say before we dive in is in this first part, we're probably going to do a two-part series on this, is we're going to look at the more allopathic style of recommendations. And for the most part, we support them. Although from a sort of functional and naturopathic medicine point of view, we will add our own commentary to some of these. But this is essentially a summary of the research that's been done by the World Cancer Research Fund and the American Institute for Cancer Research. And I think one of the important things to note about this is that so much of what I think people believe is that cancer is bad luck or bad genes. And yes, those things can be part of the picture for sure, but on a statistical level, they're contributing to less than 3% of all cancers. And I think it's a real shame that people feel like it's just a Russian roulette kind of game and that there aren't actually things we can do to reduce our risk. Now, does that mean if you do all of these things, we guarantee you won't get cancer? Of course not. There's so many things outside of your control that can also influence your immune system and inflammation and pathogenic issues. But being empowered with these guidelines, I think, is a really nice foundation to start with if you weren't already aware of these things. And then we're going to circle back into a part two at some stage with more from our toolkit as far as functional medicine practitioners go. That being said, you'll see there's a lot of crossover here, particularly in the nutritional section, that we also really support and obviously want to share with you today. So, without further ado, we're going to dive in, and I'm going to start with the first recommendation from this summary, and that is to be as lean as possible within the normal slash healthy range of body weight. Now, I'm all for loving the body that you're in. And I also think there are people who are in the ideal body weight range who are incredibly unhealthy. And there are people who might be a little bit underweight or a little bit overweight, but might be doing a little bit better on other health scores. But if we're looking at it from a purely medical point of view, being overweight increases the risk of many cancers. And that's just a fact. What I'll also say about that is being overweight in childhood also makes you more likely to be overweight or obese in adulthood. And so the recommendations that have come out in this guide is to, certainly if you're a parent, make sure that your child, that throughout childhood and also adolescence, is within a normal healthy weight range. In fact, this guide goes as far as to say you should keep them at the lower end of normal or healthy. And ideally, as adults, we should maintain ourselves in the normal slash healthy weight range from age of 21. Now, ultimately, shit happens, and we know that weight can be influenced by all kinds of things, including infection, inflammation, injury, trauma, and weight issues can arise in childhood, in adolescence, and in adulthood. But it ultimately boils down to the fact that by maintaining your weight in a healthy range and staying sort of at the lower end of normal, you significantly reduce your risk of many cancers. So whatever we can do in terms of healthy strategies of maintaining our weight is a really powerful way of reducing our risk of cancer. Now, why is that? There's a number of reasons which we can't go into in detail in this episode. That's probably a whole other chat. But ultimately, adipose tissue, which is the fancy scientific name for our body fat, is not just inert tissue. It's actually an active endocrine organ in and of itself. It upregulates inflammation. We know that inflammation is a significant driver when it comes to cancer. It also affects hormones through a number of different mechanisms, which then, of course, contributes to hormone-dependent cancers. It's also a repository for fat-soluble toxins. And so if we're carrying around toxins every day in our fatty tissues, carcinogens, they are going to be a constant source of cancer potential. And so, yeah, there are just a few reasons why carrying extra fat on our bodies can increase our risk of cancer. So in short, keeping your weight in the normal healthy range, and I would also say your body composition is arguably, you know, a more nuanced and accurate way of addressing this, because weight's just our relationship to gravity. That's going to serve you long term for reducing your risk of cancer. Mm. And part of that leads into the next point. What do you say about that, Nat?
What do you say about that, Nat? I love that. Well, I have so much to say, as always, but I think I just want to reiterate again what you said there. I think this conversation around healthy weight and weight generally is very, like, can be really triggering and also polarizing, because there seems to be almost like a lack of occupation in the space between love your body at every size, body positivity, and then the opposite of just like weight obsessed, lean obsessed, abs obsessed. And so I just really want to encourage you to try and take as like an objective approach to, like, you know, I guess looking into your weight and your current body composition as you can, and reiterating the word range there, in that it really is like a range that we sit in, and everyone has a natural tendency, you know, towards a certain type of body composition. But when it comes to, as Amy's saying, reducing the risk of cancer, it's ensuring that, you know, we're somewhere in the middle or down the lower end of that, and using also your own judgment in terms of your body composition. Because I know that when we're talking about healthy weight range, that's often based on things like BMI, and BMI isn't always 100% accurate for people who, for example, are carrying more muscle mass. Mm. And also, I just think use some common sense, to be honest. Like, you kind of know roughly when you're in a healthy range versus not, at least when it's quite obvious. So, yeah, and then you're right, it does lead into the point that I was going to share, which is really around being physically active. So even moderate physical activity, like brisk walking or cycling, like anything that's like a moderate physical activity type exercise for at least 30 minutes a day has been shown to be protective against cancers. And also alongside that, really limiting your really sedentary time. So limit the time that you're spending watching TV. And of course, we all go through, you know, a weekend here and there where maybe you're just a couch potato and that's what you need. But this is more speaking to what is habitually your approach to movement or lack of. And I think this can be something that really creeps up on people because life gets really busy. And this is where I often think about integrating movement into your daily habits and routines as part of a non-negotiable, and recognizing as well, which might sound a bit harsh, but you don't have to identify as someone who is sporty, athletic, an exerciser, or you don't even have to love exercise in order to do it. You just have to realize that it is part of maintaining and achieving good health, and absolutely as part of cancer prevention. And also, it's, you know, when we're speaking about this, part of the reason, or part of the other focus that I guess Amy and I would add to this, is that building active tissue, like lean muscle mass, and focusing also on strength and flexibility is important. So it's, while absolutely, if you, all you can manage right now is doing brisk walking for 30 minutes a day, every day, go for it. That's great. And also, I really feel like, or at least I encourage my clients to, you know, also participate in some form of strength and mobility or flexibility training, so that we're not just putting all our eggs in one basket when it comes to physical activity. So, and obviously, being active is protective against unnecessary weight gain, or is also another strategy in helping you maintain your weight. So, yes, love that for us. Love some movement. Plus, movement is just it's so beneficial for so many other things. And I hope that this is coming to you at, you know, at the right time of year, where maybe you are feeling a little bit more motivated about moving your body again. And just focus on, first and foremost, you know, the balance between what do I enjoy, or if you don't enjoy it, what can I tolerate? What can I access? And what can I be consistent with? And just try and find where that overlaps the most, and then start there. You don't have to set unrealistic, like huge goals that just you feel anxious even looking at when you write down. I think really meeting yourself where you're at, and knowing that anything you do in that direction is only going to be of benefit.
I love that so much. And I think the timing of this is really a good opportunity to talk about playing the long game. I was having a conversation with one of my best friends, you know, about New Year's goals, and he was saying how, like, what's been his undoing, and I think we've all made this mistake probably more than once, is we get all excited and motivated and enthusiastic, and we want to, you know, write out the perfect plan, and we just aim way too many steps away from where we are. So just looking at where you're at and moving yourself up the next step is all you need to do. And then at some point, you know, right now you might only be able to walk 5 minutes a day. So building up to 10 and then 20 and 30 is great. If you're already doing 30 minutes a day, you're killing it. And maybe you want to look at some other types of exercise to add in. So love that for you. But remember, you don't have to, you know, do things perfectly or fix everything at once. The next thing I want to cover off is limiting the consumption of energy dense fast foods and sugary drinks. Now, we live in a time where hyperpalatable processed foods are so easy to get and so cheap. And look, the research fund and the cancer research group will say that this is primarily to limit weight. But what I'll say is, and Nat would notice this too in clients, is that the more you're filling up on nutritionally void foods, the less room you have to consume nutrient dense foods, which generally means people are overall consuming less phytonutrients or micronutrients in general. And that's not even touching on the problematic ingredients, some of which are carcinogens, but others that are inflammagens or endocrine disrupting, that can be in the foods as well. So, you know, I know it sounds like common sense, but processed foods have become so insidious and are often marketed as health food. So things like cereals and muesli bars and, you know, a lot of gluten-free items also. Now, as someone who's gluten-free, obviously they're a godsend in many ways, but they're often quite refined, and sometimes quite energy dense as well. So watch out for that, because those things in and of themselves can be problematic. They can be creating blood sugar and insulin issues, but of course they crowd out the opportunity to consume foods that have beneficial ingredients, don't they, Nat?
Oh my God, I'm like kind of just burning a little bit inside because I'm, as you were saying that, I'm remembering some of the dietary advice that was given to my mum when she was at when she actually had cancer and was going through her cancer treatment. Mm. And it's just, maybe that's another podcast in and of itself. It just, it's just terrible advice. And it reminds me of why I chose not to become a hospital dietitian way back when I first graduated from my first degree. I just can't believe that some of the things that are recommended, and I don't say that in a pedestal way or in a way of like expecting perfection, but it's just makes no bloody sense and also just contradicts these recommendations as they stand anyway. But Natalie's going to untie her knickers and not let them knot up and overflow into this episode. We will park that conversation for perhaps another time, or we might be here all day. Okay. So yeah, the next one, I guess, is a bit of a flow effect from what you were sharing as well. If we're, you know, limiting those overly energy dense processed foods, then what do we actually want to invite into our plate? And everyone has a different approach. I really like the crowd out approach in terms of focusing on what you actually want to be filling your plate with, so that there's just less and less room for those processed and packaged foods. Because you're right, Ames. I think that, of course, I mean, all of our listeners are going to be like, well, duh, when it comes to a lot of the really obvious processed and packaged foods. But I also think that we live now in a time where we just are exposed to an abundance of options, and those healthified versions sometimes can maybe not be as bad, but they're not far off, because a lot of the time the same combos do the trick, you know, fat, salt, sugar, together, and you can create that easily with, you know, a refined but quote unquote whole foods based product too. So I think just making sure that if you are someone who loves, you know, a sneaky treat, you know, and you're always on the lookout for what's the next gluten-free treat or new packaged food that you can get, like, sure, choose the best option that you can, but don't let it overcrowd the rest of the actual whole foods unprocessed stuff. So on that note, like, the other point that they make in this in these recommendations, which I do actually agree with on a population level, is just making sure that you are eating plenty of plant matter. You know, things like vegetables and fruits, and, you know, if you need an aim, to aim for around like 5 servings of non-starchy veggies and about 2 servings of fruit per day is, I guess, a good general aim, give or take a little bit depending on your unique circumstances. And, you know, again, like, there's always going to be nuance to this, in that some people with crazy digestive issues that they're trying to sort out might not be able to eat that much fiber initially, and you have to sort out your gut issues before that feels comfortable in your digestive system. And, you know, some people will just, you know, for other reasons might be finding that difficult, but it's we're speaking, I guess, to on a statistical level and general trends or habits, what seems to be cancer protective. And a lot of this comes back to, you know, the polyphenols, the antioxidants, the vitamins and minerals that are found within these foods. And, you know, before anyone listening who has maybe heard of the carnivore diet or has tried that themselves or has been, you know, I guess, pulled into that world, yes, plants do contain food chemicals that they produce to protect themselves, and arguably have the whoever's eating them or the predators not necessarily want to consume them again. But antioxidants and polyphenols, they're actually what we call like a hormetic stress, as in you consume these and your body almost like adapts in a positive way in response to them. And so I really think that's where not kind of getting confused with very like polarizing black or white messaging that's out there in any camp, like in any end of the extreme. I often find that most of the time the magic does lie in the middle. And also, of course, in the individualization for your season. But I don't feel like most people can go wrong with having that general aim of just aiming to have enough, you know, fiber and plant matter and antioxidant rich food on their plate, and trying not to let the starchy, delicious vegetables only consume your plate. I speak from a true deep love of sweet potato and potato here. So I more mean like try and make sure that when you're thinking about the veggies that you're buying in the week, that you're not only focusing on those. They can be in there, absolutely nothing wrong with them, but just ensuring that really when we're talking about those five servings of veg, we're talking about trying to get them from those non-starchy vegetables first.
Yeah, I love that. And this is definitely an area I think a lot of people fall down. Last statistics the Australian Bureau published shared that only 1.3% of Australians eat the recommended 5 veg, 2 fruit a day. So that's a huge opportunity for us all to step up our game. Another recommendation from this guide, which I have mixed feelings about, is limit animal foods and processed meat. Now, when you actually look at the research on animal foods, a lot of them have confounding factors or are really poorly designed. And so I actually disagree with animal foods, although everything in balance and also what's right for you in the season of your life and your bio-individuality. And I think it's silly actually to lump in grass-fed organic meat, for example, alongside processed meats that might have, you know, any number of preservatives, fillers, you know, other food additives, whether that's flavor enhancers or something else that we know to be carcinogenic or inflammagens or disrupting to the microbiome. So I personally, when I look at this, view those two categories of animal foods quite differently.
And yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think it's crazy to think that they are remotely the same in terms of their benefits and in terms of any potential problematic risks. Now, do I think if someone's, you know, under stress, zinc deficient, not making enough stomach acid, has a microbiome issue, that maybe their digestion or their diet needs to be modified short term and so that can be addressed? Sure, it's a little bit like what Nat mentioned before about, you know, consuming enough fiber. We, you know, we want people to have at least 20 grams, ideally 30. Some research says up to 50. But if you tried to do that with someone with SIBO, you'd blow an intestine. So, you know, all of this, of course, is very nuanced. But what I will say is optimal digestion allows people to break food down effectively. Now, optimal digestion also includes optimal nervous system status. And I know we touch on that quite a bit. And we talked about that with gut healing in another episode. But so I think when we look at the general population and we look at a lot of those other variables, I think, you know, this particular recommendation is something I personally and professionally, I think requires more nuance. But I think the next one, Nat, is fairly cut and dried.
Yeah. Limit alcohol is the next one.
And bow, bow, bow.
Yeah. Bow, bow. I really maybe controversial to say, but I really don't think that alcohol has any health benefits.
Mm-mm.
Like, as in you have to drink so much alcohol to get a therapeutic level of something like resveratrol from it. And by the time you drink that much, the detriments outweigh the benefits. But I also recognize we're in a society, particularly in Australia, and I imagine in New Zealand as well, where it's just such, I mean, I guess it's everywhere, but definitely notice it in Australia, it's just such a cultural thing and it's so normalized. And I think a lot of people feel actually really uncomfortable about limiting drinking or not drinking, as in like that's how culturally ingrained it can be. But I guess, you know, in terms of trying to give some form of recommendation or what they suggest in these guidelines is limiting to no more than two drinks a day for men and one for women on average. But I would argue to say that like the less the better is yes. how I would frame it, and really also avoiding binge drinking, because some people who maybe aren't like who just like to find workarounds might be like, sweet, I'll just save my drinks up and just use them all on a Saturday. But it just, it doesn't quite work like that. So I really think just trying to really understand your relationship with alcohol is a great place to start. And then from there, you know, trying to make steps towards reducing it. Because I don't, even though it feels culturally normal, it's not in the way that we approach it in Australian society, in how much we drink. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with saying no. And I think the more you practice saying no, the more comfortable you get with it. And the reason why I think sometimes there's a lot of discomfort around it is because your no can be triggering for other people around you. Yeah, I guess that's my two cents on it. I'm not saying you can never drink, but I just mean really if alcohol has been a struggle for you, really starting to have a look at that and how you can maybe make steps towards reducing it.
Yeah, I think so too. I know, you know, we probably have a whole range of beautiful humans that listen to the podcast. And for some people, they'll be like, wow, that I, you know, I drink way more than that. And then others might be like, gosh, that's a lot, like, because that's ultimately 10 drinks a week for men and 10, hang on, where's my maths? 14 and 7 for women. And like, that's a lot. That's actually still a lot. And even is pretty questionable when it comes to the definition of alcoholism as well. But you're so right. It's just become such a cultural thing too. I think it's the lines are very blurry. And I think it would be fair to say there's no safe level of consumption. And I personally, you know, recommend for clients if they're going to consume alcohol regularly. And I am speaking of, you know, the president of the Chardonnay fan club here. So please don't think I'm sitting in my ivory tower saying don't drink. But I normally say like 1 to 3 alcoholic drinks a week is what I think would be a less risky position to take, and ideally zero, you know, of course. And I'm never having zero, by the way. So don't think that that's, you know, something you you have to aim for, but definitely there's no safe level of consumption. Every bit does have some impact on the body. So less is more in this case. The next guideline is limiting salt as well as moldy grains, legumes, and foods. Now, salt is obviously necessary for human health and life. I also think salt is a whole other conversation we could have. I'm going to pop that in the overflow ideas tab, Nat, about the quality of salt and how we're supposed to consume salt. But 2,500 milligrams a day is, you know, roughly what we should be aiming for health. But if you eat processed foods, you might be getting way too much. And what we know is that salt, and more specifically salt preserved foods, are a probable cause of some cancers. So it's not definitive. It's probably more likely to be the fact that these foods are preserved and what else is in them than the sodium itself being inherently problematic, but it's still a bit difficult to say. So keeping an eye on the overall amount is not, you know, not a bad idea. That being said, many mycotoxins or toxins produced by mold are carcinogenic. And we know with certainty that aflatoxins cause liver cancer or are a cause of liver cancer. And we know a lot of mycotoxins in food also cause stomach cancer and gastrointestinal cancers. So be very mindful of that. And that leaves us the last point, which we have feelings about, don't we, Nat?
Yes. Their last point, which we're like, no, maybe not that passionately, but one of their recommendations is aim to meet nutritional needs through diet alone. So where we agree is that, great, have that as a goal, because you're obviously, if you've got that as a goal, you're going to hopefully if common sense prevails, be trying to consume nutrient-dense foods, which is always going to be a win. However, I would say in my clinical experience, and Amy, you can add your own two cents here as well, that for the large majority of people, I don't actually feel like that can happen in terms of, I think you could potentially avoid like a really overt deficiency in most things, but I don't think you can achieve optimal health through diet alone, because I don't think that our soils are as rich in nutrients as they once were. I think our food travels further. I think we're more stressed environmentally, but also just generally, and therefore deplete a lot of the key vitamins and minerals than, you know, we would otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so I find that most people benefit from some form of smart supplementation top up that ideally is individualized.
Yeah, 100%. And again, we're going to do an episode on that. I've just got so many ideas in the overflow tab. And the last thing I'll say, which is just a special recommendation for mothers with infants, and that is breastfeeding. So the public health goal, of course, is the majority of mums to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months and to continue beyond 6 months if possible, alongside complementary feeding. And there's probably a lot we could have talked about here, but the main points that this the research summary makes is it for the mother specifically reduces the risk of breast cancer, and it also reduces the risk of overweight and obesity in children, which of course is a major driver when it comes to cancer. Now, breastfeeding also protects against infections. We know infections can drive cancers. It also protects and develops the immature immune system and protects against other childhood diseases, as well as being vital for the bond between mother and child. And there's a lot to be said about that and the nervous system and the immune system. But overall, this is actually the first time the summary has included recommendations around breastfeeding and specifically as it relates to cancer. So yeah, if you are a mum or a mum-to-be, this is something you should also have to think about too.
Yeah. And obviously we say that with a deep compassion for anyone who has had that as a desire but hasn't been able to fulfill that and has needed to bottle feed for whatever reason or has chosen to bottle feed for whatever reason. I guess, you know, whenever we're talking about choices around breastfeeding, it's important, I guess, that we're open and transparent with what the research supports and also know that There is no judgment in that. We absolutely appreciate that we're all just doing the best we can with what we've got. The last thing I just wanted to triple check in on before we wrap up is, did they not include not smoking in their recommendations? Because I feel like that could be.
Oh, I know. Unbelievably, no. So hence why we're going to do a part two, because not only are there's some obvious omissions, there's also a lot that hasn't been considered here because it's outside of like general allopathic public health. So stand by, but also thanks for pointing that out.
Oh my God, so much stand by. Hey, I have so many things to add here. So we will, but we won't, because we'll go off on a tangent and we're trying very hard not to, but we will bring you a part two. And also if you do have any like questions that you would like us to incorporate into part two as it relates to cancer risk prevention, please feel free to send either of us a DM and we will do our best to include that in the conversation as well.
Love that.
All right, friends. Well, thank you for tuning in as always, and we look forward to being in your ear holes again next week.
See you then. Bye. You've been listening to the Holistic Health Podcast with Amy and Nat.
If you loved this episode, then make sure you share it on Instagram and give us a tag.
If you'd like to help us spread the holistic health message far and wide, then we would also so appreciate it if you left a rating and review. This helps us more than you know.
And don't forget to come and say hi over on Instagram. See you next week.